the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parviskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Mathalul ladhina yunfiquna amwalahum fi sabilillah كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Partial results from Iran's presidential election put Ebrahim Raisi well ahead of other candidates with more than 60% of the votes. The Yemeni army launches a drone attack on Saudi Arabia's King Khalid military airbase near the city of Khamis Mashayad. Also in the headlines, the U.S. says it is reducing the number of troops, aircraft, and anti-missile systems in the West Asia region. Welcome to our studios near the capital, Tehran. We will start this bulletin with the latest updates on Iran's presidential election. Iran has announced partial results from the June 18 presidential election. The judiciary chief, Ebrahim Raisi, is leading with more than 17,800,000 votes. He has promised to fight corruption and uproot poverty. Mohsen Rezai is ranked second with over 3,300,000 votes. His campaign slogan was an overhaul of the country's governance and economy. Abdel Nasser Hemeti managed to garner 2.4 million votes and is in third place. And last, Iranian lawmaker Amir Hossein Ghazizadeh Hashemi has garnered nearly 1 million votes. Over 59.3 million Iranians were eligible to vote for one of the four presidential candidates. Frontrunner in Iran's presidential election, Ebrahim Raisi, has been congratulated by other candidates for winning Friday's vote. Mohsen Rezai, Abdel Nasser Hemeti, and Amir Hossein Ghazizadeh Hashemi sent congratulatory messages to Raisi as partial results put him well ahead of his rivals. Rezai said the June 18th vote has once again improved the efforts of the Iranian nation in protecting and strengthening the security and power of their country. Hemeti expressed hope that the new administration would bring comfort and prosperity to the nation. Ghazizadeh Hashemi appreciated what he called the massive and glorious turnout of vigilant and loyal people of the country. Iran's current president, Hassan Rouhani, also expressed gratitude for people's participation, precision, and punctuality. Iran held its 13th presidential election on Friday. Okay, Alexander Asad Khan, professor and senior geopolitical advisor, joins us from Irvine. Welcome, Azad Khan. We're looking at a possible victory by Ebrahim Raisi. All the votes have not been counted, but it looks like he's going to take this. This is obviously a new chapter, as it is with any presidential elections for any country. But for Iran, it's a different. It's going to be a different scenario. What type of scenario would that be if it's going to be different?
If you talk to the average ordinary Iranian and tell him this is a pivotal election, some of them who may not necessarily be happy with things, and I don't blame them, especially economically, may complain and say they have been telling us for 40 years that this is going to be pivotal. My response to these people is just two words: you'll see. The country is taking a different direction. The system is taking a different direction. These are very sensitive times we are living in.
So at this point, we heard the Interior Ministry talking about the security of the elections, how well that was done and executed, which is obviously very important. But looking at the possibility of Raisi, a strong one, that he is the winner, you were speaking about what Iran would be facing. Please go ahead.
Yes, thanks, Kaveh. I think the Iranian leadership should prepare itself for tensions that would be created from outside, chiefly Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is the world's greatest state sponsor of terrorism. They actually, one of their princes several years ago admitted to this in a political article to Zalmay Khalilzad, former U.S. Ambassador to Afghanistan, and then after that, I believe he was U.S.'s U.N. representative. So we have to watch what happens in the Sistan-Baluchistan province. This is a predominantly Sunni province of Iran, Iranian Sunnis. We have to watch what the Al-Ahwaz movement would do in the oil-rich province of Khuzestan. We have to watch some of the negative comments and strange comments coming from Mr. Erdogan when it comes to the Iranian Azeris in the northwest of Iran. And I think that's why this gentleman, Dr. Zoltaghari, was on to point out to those and to reassure the Iranian people as well as the global audience that Iran is on top of this, very much on top of this, because they're anticipating further interruption and further intrusion in their domestic political landscape. So you should be watching for more of, hopefully not, I hope I'm wrong in this forecast, but you know, I'm sure the Iranian intelligence services really have their eyes open at this time.
Thank you so much for
yeah.
All right, appreciate it. Thank you very much, political analyst Alexander Azadgal. We do appreciate your comments.
Thank you.
But political commentator Said Hosseini says that a government backed by the popular vote, we're going to listen to him now, will have a strong position while negotiating with other countries.
It's more a celebration than election in Iran. Celebration of democracy, celebration of the wish and the will of people, which prevails at the end, and also celebration of their victory against all of the odds, as the double standard of the entire world when it comes to the democracy. Some of these Western countries, they don't want to admit about the existence of democracy in the Islamic Republic of Iran. And I think the Iranian nation has realized this double standard, and in spite of all of the problems that they have inside, from economical point of view, from sanction point of view, you can see that the different forks of life, teachers, students, clergies, the traders, every single person who is loving their nation and who love their progress and their democracy have been participating. A government which is backed by the vote of people have an upper hand when they do negotiation.
Political commentator Masoud Shajadeh says opponents of the Islamic Republic are intimidating Iranians abroad to stop them from voting.
There is a double standard and a hypocrisy going on. You're seeing people who are opponents of Islamic Republic, and as a matter of fact, there are supporters of either being promoted by the Saudis or by the Americans or by other powers who see themselves an opponent of the Islamic Republic. These guys, on one with one breath of they say that there is no democracy in Iran, and then at the same time they're trying to stop people actually going and voting, and they're intimidating them, they're bullying them. We've seen it in London and elsewhere. People are being really intimidated in a very vicious way to stop them voting, and then at the same time they actually complain that they say that the system in Iran, the government hasn't got support. So really they're trying to create a news and then sort of promote it and to undermine the will of the people.
The Yemeni army says it has carried out an airstrike on an airbase inside of Saudi Arabia. Army spokesman Yahya Sari says that a Fasab 2K drone targeted the King Khalid base near the southwestern Saudi city of Khamis Mashayat. Sari says the operation was successful, with the target being hit precisely. According to Sari, the attack was in response to Saudi Arabia's military aggression and continued siege. The Saudi-led military coalition launched a war in Yemen in 2015 with the aim of reinstating a friendly regime there. Yemeni forces have stepped up their retaliatory attacks against the kingdom in recent months. They've been pushing for the lifting of the blockade on Yemen and an end to the war that has killed tens of thousands of people. Yemenis have held a symposium in the capital city of Sana'a to discuss the decades-long Israeli aggression against the Palestinians. The symposium is aimed at raising awareness on the importance of supporting the Palestinian cause. Abdul Latif Al-Moshali has more.
Jerusalem is closer than ever is the slogan of a symposium held in Yemeni capital Sana'a to discuss the Israel's long-lasting atrocities against the Palestinian nation. The organizers say the recent 11-day war has proved that the third generation of Palestinians is more capable of standing against Israel. They say the resistance has got stronger despite the normalization efforts of some Arab states.
The axis of resistance was able to prove its existence despite all the conspiracies of the closest people. There are Arab countries that are considered close to the Palestinian resistance, but unfortunately, they continue to stab the resistance through normalization with the Zionist entity. And these countries are the ones who seek to weaken and bring down the resistance. Today, the third generation of the Palestinians is capable more than ever of defending Palestine against Israel's aggression.
The gathering also hailed the support of allies for Palestinian cause, including Iran, who they say has always backed the Palestinian nation overtly. The participants said Iran has played a key role in changing the balance of the war between Palestine and the Israeli regime.
Since the establishment of the Islamic Republic of Iran 40 years ago, it has made Palestine its main issue, as Imam Khomeini declared that Iran's independence will not be complete without the liberation of Palestine. The Palestinian cause is at the heart of Iran's political strategy, and despite the conspiracies that Iran has gone through, it still supports the Palestinian resistance and has been a key factor in changing the equation of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict.
The Palestinian cause is also an issue of consideration for several other Islamic states, including Yemen. Last month, Yemenis launched a fundraising campaign to support the Palestinian resistance groups, even though they are going through a tragic humanitarian situation due to the ongoing Saudi war on their country.
People here believe that armed struggle is the only way to stand against aggressors. They say the recent victory proved that the Palestinian nation is on the right path to regain its rights. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Israeli forces have injured at least 56 Palestinians in separate attacks in the occupied territories. Nine Palestinian protesters were wounded after Israeli forces stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in East Jerusalem Al-Quds. Regime forces fired rubber-coated bullets, tear gas, and stun grenades. Israeli forces also arrested at least 10 demonstrators. The Palestinians were protesting against Tuesday's flag march by Israeli settlers in Al-Quds. During the parade, the settlers, escorted by army forces, chanted insulting slogans against the Prophet Muhammad while shouting death to Arabs. Also on Friday, at least 47 Palestinians were injured by Israeli troops near the West Bank town of Beita. The Palestinians were demonstrating against the new settlement outpost there. Mona Kandil says that Israel is using excessive force to stop Palestinians from taking part in demonstrations while backing Israeli settlers to steal more land and to build illegal settlements.
Palestinian experts and human rights organizations say that Israeli forces are using excessive force in order to terrify the Palestinian villagers and the protesters in order not to take part in these demonstrations and protests. At the same time, they continue to protect the Israeli settlers to steal and to seize more lands and annex them to illegal settlements, or even to steal these lands and build illegal settlements.
The U.S. Defense Department says Washington has started to cut the number of its anti-missile systems in the West Asia region. The Pentagon says it is pulling one THAAD and 8 Patriot missile systems, along with hundreds of troops supporting them from the region. The U.S. is also reducing jet fighter squadrons assigned to West Asia as part of the withdrawal process that started on June 2nd. The military hardware is being pulled mainly from Saudi Arabia, but also from Kuwait and from Iraq. The administration of President Joe Biden has pledged to reduce the U.S. military presence in the region to focus on what it calls threats from China and Russia. However, Washington is expected to maintain a substantial military presence, including thousands of troops in the region, especially in Iraq and in Syria. And that does it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
the supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
In the limelight.
Before Donald Trump, Barack Obama's Justice Department did more to hurt press freedom than any U.S. administration since Richard Nixon. We're prepared for you an article written by Trevor Tim. The piece is titled, Trump Spied on Journalists, So Did Obama. America Needs More Press Freedom Now. The article has been taken from the website of the British newspaper The Guardian. Please stay with us for more of Trevor Tim's article. U.S. Department of Justice is under increasing fire for the still unfolding scandals involving the secret surveillance of journalists and even members of Congress in the waning days of the Donald Trump presidency. Some of these actions were even initially defended by the Biden administration's Department of Justice. In response to the growing scandal and the scathing condemnations from the surveillance targets at the New York Times, the Washington Post, and CNN, the U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland has vowed the Department of Justice will no longer use legal process to spy on journalists doing their jobs. The New York Times, the Washington Post, and CNN are set to meet with the Justice Department in coming days to seek more information on what happened and extract further promises it won't happen again. But mark my words, if Congress does not pass tough and binding rules that permanently tie the Department of Justice's hands, it will happen again, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican in the White House. Promises are no longer enough. In my circles, these scandals are being portrayed as the Trump White House run amok. While some in the Trump Justice Department may have been motivated by political vengeance, the problem is far bigger than Donald Trump, William Barr, or even the party in charge of the White House. As the reporter Charlie Savage detailed in an excellent piece in the New York Times recently, administrations in both political parties have spied on journalists with increasing abandon for almost two decades, in contravention of internal Department of Justice regulations and against the spirit of the First Amendment. Many people already forget that before Donald Trump was known as enemy number one of press freedom, Barack Obama's Justice Department did more damage to reporters' rights than any administration since Richard Nixon. Yes, Attorney General Merrick Garland needs to immediately put his no more spying on reporters vow into the Department of Justice's official media guidelines, which cover investigations involving journalists. If he doesn't, he or his successor could change their mind in an instant. But why should Americans just trust Garland's pinky promise to not investigate journalists and politicians without an ironclad law? Leaks of confidential and classified information to journalists are vital to U.S. democratic system. Yet, the Department of Justice often diverts huge resources to root out their sources. If you want an example, look no further than ProPublica's recent investigation into the American tax system and how the wealthiest billionaires in the country pay little to no taxes. The series of stories sparked outrage across the country as soon as it was published. Merrick Garland leapt into action, vowing an investigation, only he promised to investigate the leaker and not the tax dodgers. The rise of internet communications has opened the floodgates to authorities' abilities to spy on journalists and root out whistleblowers. They can figure out exactly who journalists are talking to, where, when and how long, and they can silence media lawyers with expansive gag orders that could leave them almost helpless to appeal. And as the coronavirus pandemic has rendered in-person meetings even harder than before, people everywhere are more reliant on the communications infrastructure that can betray them at any time. For real safeguards, Congress needs to act. Perhaps the fact that multiple members of Congress itself, including the representatives Adam Schiff and Eric Swalwell, have now been ensnared in the Department of Justice's leak dragnet, will make them more likely to move than in the past. The irony is Representative Adam Schiff and Representative Eric Swalwell have, of course, been some of Congress's most ardent defenders of surveillance, even during the Trump administration. They fought against surveillance reform that would put in more safeguards at the Department of Justice on multiple occasions. In Representative Schiff's case, despite literally being the co-chair of the Press Freedom Caucus, he inserted a provision into an intelligence bill that would even make it easier for the government to prosecute reporters who publish leaked classified information. Being the victim of unjust surveillance sometimes tends to make even the most devoted surveillance hawks soften their stance. If Attorney General Merrick Garland is promising to bar the surveillance of journalists for the purpose of finding their sources, Congress can simply pass a law holding them to it. Anything else at this point is just empty rhetoric. But there is another issue looming large over this debate, one that many seem hesitant to talk about. Attorney General Merrick Garland has said so far that the Department of Justice won't spy on journalists unless they're engaged in a crime. Well, the Department of Justice has currently attempted to make news gathering a crime in the form of its case against the WikiLeaks founder, Julian Assange. U.S. officials claim Assange is not popular in Washington, D.C. and in mainstream journalism circles. However, the actions described in the indictment against him, most notably the 17 Espionage Act charges, are indistinguishable for what reporters do all the time. Talk to sources, cultivate their trust, request more information, receive classified documents, and eventually publish them. News outlets like the New York Times and Washington Post already know what a threat the case is to their reporters' rights. They've said so in public. However, it's vital that they say this to the Attorney General's face. Right now, there is little pressure on the Department of Justice to drop the Julian Assange charges, despite the fact that virtually every civil liberties and human rights group in the United States has protested against them. If Merrick Garland bars surveillance of journalists doing their jobs, but secures a conviction that makes journalists' jobs a crime, his promises will ultimately be worse than meaningless.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Minutes.
Salmon Fishing in Yemen, a film produced in 2011 starring Ewan McGregor. Its whimsical story has little to do with what fishermen are going through in the war-torn country. Now close your eyes and imagine you are a fisherman. You have a boat and a sea full of fish in front of you and a family who depends on you. Imagine fish is the only means of sustenance. Then why should you stay at home looking at the empty plates? You cannot tolerate the emaciated bodies of your children any longer. You go to the sea. You get arrested. The enemy puts you in a secret prison while your family looks everywhere for you. This is the fate of many Yemeni fishermen arrested by the Saudi-led coalition. One day in May 2020, a group of Yemeni fishermen who were working with the Golden Star Company were arrested by the Saudi Coast Guard in the Red Sea near a Yemeni island. They were accused of being in a closed area, despite all the official permits they had obtained from the coalition. In the words of the captain of the boat, when we were on the return trip, our boat had stopped near a Yemeni island, having run out of fuel in the wake of very high winds. After the distress call was made, a force from the Saudi Coast Guard came not to rescue, but to arrest us. They took us to the Farzan prison in Jizan on charges of reconnaissance. In fact, since the onset of the war in 2015, the Saudi-led coalition has been patrolling the length and breadth of the Yemeni coasts.
Yemeni fishermen have been targeted by the Saudi-U.S. coalition for arrest, detention, and torture in Saudi prisons since 2015. In many instances, their fishing boats are attacked by Saudi coalition vessels and aircraft and have been burnt, damaged, and even sunk. And a number of Yemeni fishermen have been injured, shot, burned, killed, and left to drown in the sea. As a result, many Yemeni fishers, actually most Yemeni fishers, have stopped going fishing because they find it too dangerous to be out on the sea with the Saudi coalition roaming and being very belligerent. So they remain in port, and as a consequence, they are unemployed and unable to feed their families. They're also unable to feed the Yemeni people. And so this becomes not only a crisis for the fisher people, but also for the Yemeni people in general.
In early May this year, Saudi Arabia released 11 Yemeni fishermen after detaining them for more than 40 days. Saudi forces had kidnapped 24 fishermen in mid-July while they were fishing in the territorial waters. By many accounts, these poor people are a few out of thousands of Yemenis arrested in Yemeni waters under various pretexts. But they're also among the luckiest. In August 2018, Human Rights Watch published a disturbing report on the circumstances of the Yemeni fishermen, but it fell on deaf ears.
According to a report by a Geneva-based group whose acronym is SAM, S-A-M, there are hundreds of Yemeni fishermen who have been illegally arrested, illegally detained in Saudi prisons, in a number of Saudi prisons. And they have, in these prisons, they have not been represented by legal counsel. They are not allowed to contact their families. They are not given access to representatives of the Yemeni government. And furthermore, they're tortured. And the types of torture that they are forced to endure include beatings with clubs and cables, being suspended by ropes, being crucified, being electrocuted, being put into solitary confinement, and in many cases they are not given proper medical attention. Many die and have disappeared into these Saudi prisons, never to emerge again.
In their all-out war, the Saudis and their allies have brutally tried to deprive the Yemeni nation of everything, including basic foodstuff. Before the war, the fishing sector in Yemen was the country's second largest economic sector after oil, producing about 450,000 tons of seafood annually. It provided a livelihood for over 2.5 million Yemenis living along the Red Sea coast and the Gulf of Aden, according to Yemeni studies.
So by targeting the fishermen and the fishing industry, the Saudi coalition is targeting as well the entire Yemeni people, in that it's trying to destroy the resistance of the Yemeni people to the illegal Saudi, US, UK, Israeli war on them and the occupation of their country. It's like a siege, a medieval siege of the city. What the Saudi coalition is trying to do is starve the Yemeni people into submission through hunger and misery, and of course their indiscriminate attacks on civilians, in order that the Yemeni people will give up and surrender and endure a permanent Saudi occupation. So that's the purpose behind the attack on the fishermen.
Today, being a fisherman in Yemen is among the most dangerous jobs, and many times an impossible one, as many of the country's coastal waters and islands have been restricted areas for Yemeni fishermen since 2015. Fishing boats, ports, and processing sites have been systematically destroyed or damaged, and many fishermen have lost their lives. Suleiman, 45, is a fisherman from Hodeidah. He says, "I know many fishermen who have been killed at sea and in the fish market. They were without sin and had no connection to politics or the state." The current statistics depict clearly the gravity of the situation. Nearly one-third of agricultural production and fishing has disappeared since the start of the war. It's also inflicted up to $6.9 billion in damage to the fishery sector, including harbors, landing centers, and boats. At least 334 fishermen have been reported killed or injured since 2015.
The Yemeni fishermen report that they have been harassed and attacked while they have gotten too close, for the comfort of the Saudi coalition, to two islands in particular. One island is called Socotra, and the other one is called Mayun. One sits at the mouth of the Gulf of Aden, and the other one sits at the mouth of the Red Sea. And most of the shipping of the world passes daily past these two islands. And what the hidden agenda is here is that the Saudi coalition is acting in support of the U.S. government, U.S. empire, which is seeking to undermine and prevent the People's Republic of China from accomplishing its Belt and Road Initiative, its new Silk Road, which is a trade route that it's trying to establish to expand its trade across South Asia, into Africa, and into Europe.
At a time when 80% of Yemen's 30 million population is in need of humanitarian aid, working for Saudi forces sometimes becomes the only source of livelihood. The fishermen who refuse to join the enemy's camp are always subject to arrest, torture, and death for fishing in Yemen's territorial waters.
Limelight.
The heat wave gripping western United States is simultaneously breaking hundreds of temperature records, exacerbating a historic drought and priming the landscape for a summer and fall of extreme wildfire. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Manvi Singh. The piece is titled, Potentially the Worst Drought in 1,200 Years, Scientists Under Scorching U.S. Heatwave. Heatwave currently gripping southwestern United States is simultaneously breaking hundreds of temperature records, exacerbating a historic drought and priming the landscape for a summer and autumn of extreme wildfires. Salt Lake City hit a record-breaking 107 degrees Fahrenheit, 42 degrees Celsius, while in Texas and California, power grid operators are asking residents to conserve energy to avoid rolling blackouts and power outages. And all of this before we've even reached the hottest part of the summer. Among the 40 million Americans enduring the triple-digit temperatures are scientists who study droughts and the climate. They'd long forewarned of this crisis, and now they're living through it. The Guardian spoke with researchers and academics across western United States about how they're coping with the extreme heat wave. Kathleen Johnson, an associate professor of earth system science at the University of California at Irvine, said, I feel a little bit lucky because I'm in Orange County, relatively close to the coast, so the temperatures are not as severe here as they are in other parts of California and western United States. I'm worried about this summer. This doesn't bode well in terms of what we can expect with wildfire and a worsening drought. This current drought is potentially on track to become the worst that we've seen in at least 1,200 years, and the reason is linked directly to human-caused climate change. As a paleoclimatologist, my main point always is that we're able to look into the past. By looking at tree rings and other paleoclimate records, we're able to gain really important perspectives about how climate has varied and changed in the past. And having done that, it's clear that what we're experiencing now is not natural. This is undoubtedly being caused by human activities, by greenhouse gas emissions. The more we see these extreme events piled on top of each other, and not just in the western United States, but globally, the more I think the reality of climate change becomes inescapable. And it feels absolutely overwhelming and sad. And we're going to have less water, increased wildfires, and more extreme heat waves. But it's also motivating. We need to continue to push for urgent action on climate change. Wayne, a climate scientist at Institute of the Environment and Sustainability at University of California at Los Angeles, said, this is really, really bad. Here on the eastern side of the Rockies, here in Boulder, Colorado, we're seeing record high temperatures. That's the case in other parts of the state and in other states. And we're seeing smoke plumes, not from local fires, but from fires in Arizona and Utah. I think for a lot of people, it's traumatic. The fires we saw in the last couple of years were really awful. And this year, it seems like we're on the same trajectory. It kind of feels like deja vu. It does get rough sometimes, talking about these things year after year. I live in the West, and all my family pretty much lives in the West. Most of my friends live in Western United States. It's where I grew up, and seeing the landscape scale transformations that are happening here, and seeing how it's affecting people is overwhelming sometimes. But actually, to me, the most distressing part is that this is very much in line with predictions. Climate scientists have been repeating essentially the same messages and the same warnings since before I was born. Climate change is a major contributor to, if not the dominant factor, in a lot of the changes that we're seeing out in Western United States and elsewhere, and it just is going to keep getting worse unless we do something about it. And so far, you know, we have yet to do the kinds of things on a large enough scale that are actually going to make a meaningful difference. Catherine Hayhoe, a climate scientist and chief scientist at the Nature Conservancy in Texas, said, "The extreme heat and the wildfires aren't surprising, but it is just surreal to see what you only ever saw before in your research studies and models actually happening now in real life. And you're almost dumbfounded by the speed at which your projections have become reality. Climate change is loading the weather dice against us. We always have a chance of rolling a double six naturally and getting an intense record-breaking summer heat wave. But decade by decade, as the world warms, it's as if climate change is sneaking in and taking one of those numbers on the dice and turning it into another six, and then another six, and maybe even a seven. So we're seeing that heat waves are coming earlier in the year, they are longer, and they are stronger. Still, public opinion data shows that there's a disconnect, where even though about 72% of the people in the United States say global warming is happening now, only 40% say they think that it will affect them directly. But we actually did a recent study looking at climate and weather extremes. And we found that really hot, dry conditions are the only thing that most people in the United States directly connect to climate change. So right now is a really important time for scientists to communicate with the public that climate change is here, it is now, and climate action matters.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
late May, unmarked graves containing the remains of 215 indigenous children were discovered on the grounds of the Kamloops Indian Residential School in British Columbia. The grim discovery has rekindled discussion of an ominous time in the country's history.
Certainly no surprise at all. Everybody in the First Nations community knew that there are mass graves. We've been calling it for years. We've been telling the government for years that there are mass graves in every single residential school, but they didn't listen to us.
Kamloops was one out of the many residential schools in Canada designed to assimilate Indigenous children into Western culture. Around 1883, Indigenous children in many parts of Canada were forced to attend residential schools, often far from their communities.
There's nothing more painful in life than losing a child. My heart breaks today thinking of all the loving parents who never saw their children return home and who were never granted the dignity of knowing what happened.
Most of these schools were operated by churches, and all of them banned the use of Indigenous languages and Indigenous cultural practices, often through violence. Disease, as well as sexual, physical, and emotional abuse, were widespread.
Residential schools have been happening for a very long time, and it's really a tragedy for having those priests and those nuns running those schools, raping and killing and murdering and abusing those Indigenous children. And it really takes effect into all the younger generation, that intergenerational trauma. And it's really hard to move on from it.
The Kamloops School was operated by the Roman Catholic Church from 1890 until 1969, when the federal government took over the school system. Reports indicated that the students at Kamloops were severely mistreated and malnourished at times.
Many were sorely neglected, not properly fed, clothed, or housed. Others suffered physical, psychological, and sexual abuse. All were deprived of the love and care of their families, of their parents, and of their communities. These are the hard truths that are part of Canada's history.
The fact is, for many decades, Indigenous people across Canada have disappeared, suffered violence, or been killed, and the Canadian government and justice system has failed them. Sadly, this is not simply a relic of the past. To this day, the safety, security, and dignity of Indigenous people are routinely threatened, while their human rights are consistently and systematically violated.
If Canada is serious about reconciliation, we want more than words and tears. We want action, and we want a say in the control and destiny of our rights and for our children and for future generations.
Six years of hearing from nearly 7,000 witnesses to document the history of the schools show that the system was a form of cultural genocide.
I had something on my back the whole time, which was this. The culture, loss of culture, loss of language. It's dragged with me my whole life.
At the same time, the Pope has been called on to apologize for the Roman Catholic Church's role, but Pope Francis has stopped short of offering a formal apology so far, saying the sad discovery further raises awareness of the pains and sufferings of the past. According to the National Truth and Reconciliation Commission, NTRC, priests at the schools fathered infants with Indigenous students. The babies were taken away from their young mothers and killed, and in some cases, their bodies were thrown into furnaces. According to the commission, many students also died from disease, accidents, fires, and during attempts to escape. Schools would suffer mass deaths when infectious diseases swept through them. The commission estimated that at least 4,100 students had died or gone missing from the residential schools. The recent recent bombshell has once again fueled the nation's debate on how to compensate for its history of exploiting indigenous people, while many are asking how so many children could end up having a fate like these students. An estimated 150,000 indigenous children passed through the schools between their opening around 1883 and their closing in 1996.